and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Nicole Roussel, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the U.S. military today said the troop withdrawal from Syria has already begun, but refused to give a timetable for the pullout. This move comes despite National Security Advisor Bolton's announcement of a series of difficult-to-meet conditions that would need to be met before the withdrawal would happen. Next, today is day 21 of the government shutdown, tied for the longest in history. Approximately 800,000 federal workers continue to be affected by the shutdown, as well as people on Native reservations, national parks, farmers, and many others. President Trump went to the border yesterday, and there have been increasing signs that he may issue a national emergency to fund the wall. Then, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo delivered a high-profile address in Cairo yesterday, doubling down on the Trump administration's hostile posture towards Iran and pushing the regime change agenda. Pompeo purposefully chose to give his speech in the same location as former President Obama's landmark 2009 address. And then, Polish authorities arrested a Huawei sales executive, the second Huawei executive arrested in recent months. Meanwhile, trade talks between the U.S. and China have continued all week, which is being interpreted as a positive sign by financial markets. Will there be resolution from the recent trade war? And finally, again this week, we'll look at the worst, most misleading, funniest, and the just plain wrong headlines of the past week. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to Syria. The U.S. military today said that the troop withdrawal from Syria has already begun, but refused to give a timetable for the pullout. This move comes despite National Security Advisor John Bolton's announcement of a series of difficult-to-meet conditions that would need to be met before the withdrawal would happen. We're joined from the U.K. by Ambassador Peter Ford. Peter is the former U.K. ambassador to Syria. And we're joined from the San Francisco Bay Area by Rick Sterling. Rick is an investigative journalist and member of the Syria Solidarity Movement. Ambassador Ford, Rick Sterling, welcome back.
Good to be here.
Ambassador Ford, the last time we talked to you, we talked about whether or not Donald Trump's original announcement, the U.S. is going to pull its troops out of Syria, would in fact be enacted, would take place. I have to say, around here, there's lots of debates, lots of skepticism. And we keep citing you from a week ago as maybe the most, I don't know, the most important person who's following the events that we're talking to, who says, no, you actually believe this withdrawal is going to take place. Do you still think that?
Absolutely. I would double down on my prediction. I think Pompeo's speech in Cairo, his non-mention of any conditions for withdrawal, I think showed the way things are moving. Pompeo seems to be on the same wavelength as Trump. Heaven knows what game John Bolton thinks he's playing. But as military sources are quoted as saying, we the military don't take orders from Bolton. No, this is going to happen. I think it's the direction of travel that matters much more than the precise timing. Yeah, it might be staggered over several months at the outside, I believe, but it's the direction of travel because everybody else is making their calculations accordingly. The game is moving on very swiftly.
All right. Rick Sterling, Ambassador Ford, doubling down on his prediction that the U.S. in fact will withdraw the 2,000-plus troops from Syria. What's your sense?
I agree with Ambassador Ford that Pompeo's speech is an indication. It runs directly in contrast with Bolton's setting of conditions before a withdrawal would happen. The question is, what's going to happen in the meantime, even if they start this now? Some of the forces that are pushing very hard against this, it's not just the neocons and the hawks like Lindsey Graham and John Bolton. The foreign policy establishment is casting a lot of doubt on this and raising a lot of questions. And at the core of Pompeo's speech, his real acclaim is that the U.S. under President Trump is restoring good relations with their key allies, being Israel and Saudi Arabia. what's going to be the response in Saudi Arabia and Israel? And are they going to be able to upend this, destabilize it, somehow turn things around? I mean, there could be a chemical weapons incident that might happen. Some of the forces that have, you know, carried those out in the past are undoubtedly considering something like that. And, you know, I was actually, in thinking about the way Trump did this, I was reminded of John F. Kennedy's decision in 1963 to withdraw troops from Vietnam. And he did that with a National Security Action Memorandum. And he had the support of his defense secretary, McNamara. He had the support of his chief, his military leadership. They did not announce it publicly, but this decision was made to basically start by withdrawing 1,000 troops from Vietnam by the end of the year in just a few months, and then have the complete withdrawal to take place after the election in 64. Of course, we know what happened with John F. Kennedy. So there's a lot of things that can happen before those, you know, before those few thousand troops in Syria are actually withdrawn. But that said, I think it's Pompeo's speech yesterday is definitely supportive of Ambassador Ford's belief and claim that Trump is serious about, you know, changing the U.S. policy and the on the ground troops there.
Ambassador Ford, why tolerate John Bolton? If Trump is going in a different direction and Bolton is appearing to be playing games or to sabotaging this effort, Bolton, you don't even have to fire him. You could tell him, if you're the president of the United States, to shut up. But he's not, or he hasn't done so yet. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's being stage managed, to be honest. I'm not sure that Bolton is departing from the script, but he's part of the smoke screen behind which the withdrawal is taking place. He's part of the bluster. I'm sure that personally, he would do everything in his power, if he could, to nix the whole thing. Yes, yeah. And if he wanted to ensure that there'd be no Turkish assurances that they wouldn't massacre the Kurds, well, he wouldn't have gone about it by any different method than the one he did of making a statement in Israel that totally riled Erdogan. So he's playing something of a double game, I suspect. But, you know, he has important backers, especially the Israelis, and it's important to Trump to have, or for Israel to have Trump's back at the moment. And maybe you heard my theory about that, but I think that Israel has Trump's back vis-a-vis Russiagate and all that, as Trump has Israel's back. He can't afford to have too many enemies at the same time. But it's the direction of travel. I totally agree with Rick that there could be accidents along the way that could also nix the withdrawal, and Rick mentioned the possibility of a chemical weapons fake attack. Yeah, that's in my nightmares as well. But barring that, I think the die is cast. The inevitable always happens. It seems obvious, but folks very often forget the inevitable always happens. And it's going to happen this time because the Kurds have realized belatedly that the U.S. is not going to hang around forever, whether it's this year or next year, this month or next month. So they're already in deep in discussions with Damascus and Moscow. And even Bolton, in his latest statement, has said he's open to negotiation with Russia over matters concerning the withdrawal. That was interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. Let's just talk about what's new with the sort of the shift within so-called rebel camp, the armed gangs that are in control of Idlib right now in the northern part of Syria, the place where the armed forces who have been defeated have gathered together as they've been driven out of different parts of Syria. Go ahead, Rick Sterling.
Well, the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham organization has asserted its dominance in Idlib. The significant thing there is that HTS, formerly Jabhat al-Nusra, is not a party to the agreement, the deconfliction agreement that was made, that some of the armed opposition groups had some agreement with. So they've asserted their dominance there. They've crushed some of the other organizations. And that's going to open the door to, or that's going to, I think, pave the way to direct conflict sooner or later. And that's going to be the time where we see whether the Western forces, which have, you know, put up screams of alarm whenever and basically opposed the Syrian government crushing the opposition, creating humanitarian corridors for the exodus of civilians, but basically, threatening and carrying out a removal of the terrorist forces. That's where we're going to see, you know, what the response is, because the Idlib province is the last, you know, real stronghold of that force. So interesting times ahead in that area.
Yeah, we have about 45 seconds left. Same question to you, Ambassador Ford. HTS now in control, it seems, formerly al-Nusra, a rebranding for what they were in their origin, al-Qaeda. What's going to happen? 45 seconds left.
Well, the Western powers have succeeded in creating a safe haven for al-Qaeda. Idlib is the new Tora Bora. Anybody with a half a brain could see it coming. And now it has happened. The only way forward is in several months' time, after the U.S. withdrawal, that the Syrian army will take on al-Qaeda.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. We were joined from the U.K. by Ambassador Peter Ford. Ambassador Ford was the U.K.'s ambassador to Syria, and we were joined from the San Francisco Bay Area by Rick Sterling. Rick is an investigative journalist, a member of the Syria Solidarity Movement. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Today is day 21 of the government shutdown, tied now for the longest in U.S. history. Approximately 800,000 federal workers continue to be affected by the shutdown, as well as people on native reservations, national parks, farmers, and many others. President Trump went to the border yesterday, and there have been increasing signs that he may issue a national emergency to fund the wall and thus reopen the government. We are joined from Los Angeles by Juan Jose Gutierrez. Juan Jose is the executive director of the Full Rights for Immigrants Coalition. Juan Jose, welcome back.
Thank you for inviting me, Brian. Good to be with you.
How's the national emergency where you are? How's the crisis?
Well, over here, obviously, there's a lot of hysteria. People are talking about it as a big political issue, at least in the immigrant-based communities across the state. You do feel this concern that Donald Trump is really going off the rails with this false political campaign, that we have a national emergency, where what we have is a humanitarian crisis at the border, where a few thousand Central American individuals have made it to the U.S.-Mexico border to exercise their legal right to claim political asylum. The United States is branding them as illegal aliens, preventing them to exercise that American-given right to individuals that are seeking refuge. And so Donald Trump is using this thing to claim that, you know, that if he doesn't get the money from Congress that he's demanding, you know, close to $6 billion, that he may call or proclaim a national emergency and find a different way to build a wall anyways. So that's a major concern here. Even though California is a sanctuary state, the fact remains that people are still living in fear and concern that they themselves or family members could be apprehended in this climate of anti-immigrant hysteria.
Yeah, so there is a crisis for some people, but it's not the crisis Trump is talking about.
Oh, absolutely, Brian. I mean, no armies are marching on the south, north, getting ready to invade the United States of America militarily or otherwise. The only thing that we have, as I said, is that mysteriously back in August, some thousands, you know, less than 10,000 immigrants, when it was all said and done, gathered somewhere in Honduras and began, you know, the dangerous trip across several Central American countries into Mexico and then onto the U.S.-Mexico border. So at the height of this so-called national emergency crisis, we could have had as many as 7,000 people. That number has dwindled. At the moment, we have but a few hundred of these caravan members in some refuge centers that have been set up by the Mexican government to provide them with the basic necessities of life. And some individuals have made it on their own through other crossing areas across the U.S.-Mexico border, obviously more dangerous than where they are now, where they're being prevented unlawfully, I would argue, from exercising their legal right to claim political asylum protections. And so that's what we have right now. That's not a national emergency, and yet Donald Trump insists that this is a national emergency, and that if Congress does not come through and provide him with a demand, with his demand for close to $6 billion, that he will very well proclaim a national emergency and get funds from the military and get the military, the army specifically, to start building his wall.
Speaking of the military, I was looking at a guidance sent out by the Coast Guard to employees or members of the Coast Guard who are not getting paid, because 800,000 federal workers are not getting paid. Yesterday, they would have received their direct deposit pay, or today their checks. They're not getting them. That's almost a million workers. And here's what the government says to these workers who are deprived of their pay. They still have to pay bills, so it's a big deal for them. And again, there's not, because it's a national emergency, there's not an invading army. But here, Juan Jose, listen to this guidance. I want to read it to you. This is how to survive if you're a federal worker, if you're specifically part of the Coast Guard, part of the military, and you're not getting paid right now. Quote, other than cutting back on your expenses, the only other way to compensate for the loss of income is to add to your income. Having supplemental income during your furlough period might be challenging, but here are a few ideas for adding income. One, have a garage sale. Clean out your attic, basement, and closets at the same time. Two, sell unwanted large ticket items through the newspaper or online. Three, become a babysitter. Offer to watch children, walk pets, or house sit. Turn your hobby into an income. Have untapped teaching skills and expertise. Tutor students. Give music or sports lessons. And finally, become a mystery shopper. Retailers are desperate to check out their in-storage customer service and will employ you to shop and rate their service. And then finally, if you can't pay your bills, the Coast Guard tells its employees, don't avoid talking to creditors. If falling behind on your payments is a sure thing, let your creditors know and inquire about any special hardship programs or reduced payment arrangements that may be available. Now, this is not a problem for Donald Trump. It's not a problem for the members of Congress, but this is a problem, a real problem, for 800,000 people who are paid by the federal government.
You're absolutely right, Brian. You know, you started this program by asking me, you know, what's the climate in, you know, where I'm at because of this federal government shutdown. And I talked about what the immigrant community is feeling over here, but I failed to talk about, you know, the many, the thousands of Californians who are employees of the federal government that are feeling the pinch, who will not be receiving checks as of today, who live pay to check, you know, check to check, and just don't have savings, you know, to keep them going through this actual national, you know, employment crisis with the federal government, because that's what it is. So, you know, the temperature is rising, and this outrageous set of recommendations that you just read out that were issued out by the Coast Guard, you know, advising purportedly, you know, some of their members as to how best to cope with this emergency, you know, is just indicative of the lack of sensitivity by those in power towards those most affected by this national government shutdown. You know, my view is that this so-called national emergency that President Donald Trump intends to declare, continues to be nothing more than a cynical political ploy to get his way. He doesn't understand, that here in this country, with all the imperfections of the system, we have a separation of powers, and no president, the executive branch cannot, simply dictate to everyone, what needs to be done, and every wish of the president make it a reality, by executive decision. And there's no willingness on the part of this administration to do anything to come to some quick resolution that would deal with the pain that 800,000 workers are going to begin feeling as of today when they don't get their paychecks. And I'll cite an example. There's been a lot of talk in Washington that maybe there can be a quid pro quo, a trade-off between, the House of Representatives, ultimately all of Congress and the executive branch, to come to a resolution. And that would involve granting a path to citizenship to immigrants brought to the U.S. as children, right? But yesterday, Vice President Mike Pence, fizzled that out. He declared in no uncertain terms that there would be no deal to make that happen. So even though a lot of people have issues as to whether or not that would be a good trade-off that they would be willing to support, I mean, the fact that the vice president says, absolutely not, we will not legalize those immigrants that were brought to the U.S. as children in exchange for getting the border wall funds requested by the president, I think that once again is indicative of their lack of sensitivity and willingness on the part of the president, to do a minimum of what people are expecting on the other side of the aisle, to move towards resolution of this unbelievable crisis.
I hear you. That was Juan Jose Gutierrez. And again, the Trump administration says it loves active duty service members like members of the Coast Guard, but now sending them out messages. If you can't pay your bills because you're not getting paid, have a garage sale, sell your furniture, offer to babysit. And finally, Juan Jose, I want to end on this. The Coast Guard also tells these unpaid employees, acknowledge that this is hard work. Give yourself credit for doing a tough job. You are taking control of the situation and directing where you want. Review and revise often your own spending plans for the next several months. Anyway, that's really, truly disgusting. We were joined by Juan Jose Gutierrez. He's the executive director of the Full Rights for Immigrants Coalition. We talked to him from L.A. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo delivered a high-profile address in Cairo yesterday, doubling down on the Trump administration's hostile posture towards Iran and pushing the regime change agenda. Pompeo purposely chose to give his speech in the same location as former President Barack Obama's landmark 2009 address. We're joined from Beirut, Lebanon by Mohammed Mirandi. Mohammed is an expert on American studies and post-colonial literature. He teaches at the University of Tehran. Mohammed Mirandi, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, here you have the Secretary of State of the United States going thousands of miles away to the American University in Cairo to deliver a polemic against a former U.S. president, the last U.S. president, Barack Obama. Let's just talk about the speech, the significance of the speech, and how it's interpreted both, say, in Egypt, but also in other parts of the Middle East, like Lebanon, where you are, or like Iran, where you teach.
In Egypt, I don't think it went down well with the general public, especially because he spoke from a position of arrogance. He said the United States is a force for good, and Egyptians see what's going on in Gaza on a daily basis. So they don't see the United States as being such a force. They never saw the United States being such a force. If he had at least behaved in a more balanced manner and spoke about at least some sort of shortcomings in U.S. foreign policy, maybe people would have viewed it differently, but I think that his speech was rejected altogether. In Lebanon, I think the same is true. These countries that surround Israel have repeatedly been bombed, attacked, invaded by the regime, and Lebanon is its airspace is violated on a daily basis by the Israeli Air Force. So again, I don't see it having a positive effect. And in Tehran, of course, this is the traditional language and narrative that the Trump team has been using from almost day one. The 12 commandments that Pompeo declared a few months ago are more or less what we heard in Cairo. So I don't think the speech was received well anywhere, and I don't think it's going to be remembered. Unlike Obama's speech, which was very well received, even though I personally did not have any trust in him implementing any change or real change in U.S. foreign policy. But many people disagreed with me at that time, and there was a degree of optimism in Iran. And I think across the region, that was probably true as well. In this case, I think that the speech will have been forgotten within the next couple of days.
When Barack Obama made his speech at the American University of Cairo, I believe it was May 9th, 2009, if I'm not mistaken, and I might be mistaken, but it's around that time. He did something that no other U.S. head of state had done, which was to sort of briefly and sort of in a camouflaged way, but in a recognizable way, take responsibility or acknowledge U.S. responsibility for the coup d'etat in Iran in 1953 that overthrew the democratically elected government of Mohammad Mossadegh, who had been toppled by the CIA and British intelligence after the U.S. and Britain imposed very, very harsh economic sanctions on Iran for the crime of the Mossadegh government having nationalized what was then called Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, or what we now know as BP. Yeah, it seemed like a liberal, sort of a slight liberal acknowledgement of U.S. imperial crimes in the Middle East, of course, done very, very softly. But you have the impression from Pompeo's speech that the United States government, and Obama in particular, made grave mistakes leading to because he sort of acknowledged America's problems or America's weaknesses, as Pompeo stressed. And that caused chaos. That led to the Arab Spring. That led to so much suffering and strengthened the hand of Iran. I mean, that's kind of the thrust of Pompeo's speech, no?
That's right. And I think actually the problem with Obama was the exact opposite, and that he acknowledged certain shortcomings. Instead of addressing those shortcomings, we saw that ultimately Obama implemented U.S. policy as it was during the previous decades. There was a strong sense of continuity. And then we had the drone attacks in many different countries, the U.S. destruction and NATO destruction of Libya, the support for the Saudis in destroying Yemen, the dirty war in Syria, and so on. So contrary to what Pompeo was saying, the problem with Obama was that he did not address any of those issues that he admitted were problems, and he basically continued business as usual. And I think it's sort of reflective of, to a degree, of Obama's tenure in office for many people in the United States. You know, he was supposed to bring about change in the United States, change you could believe in. And ultimately, when he left power, Trump came and became president. And I think Obama is, and the people around Obama, they are the reason why Trump came to power.
Right. Mike Pompeo spoke openly as a military man, and that's why he said he had to speak bluntly. Again, everlasting pats on his own back. He also spoke as an evangelical Christian. And then he said these words, talking again about after Obama's speech in 2009 and what happened in 2010, ultimately leading to what became called the Arab Spring at the end of 2010 and the beginning of 2011. And at this critical moment, this is Pompeo, America, your longtime friend, was absent too much. Why? because our leaders gravely misread our history and your historical moment. These fundamental misunderstandings set forth in this city in 2009, meaning Obama's speech, adversely affected the lives of hundreds of millions of people in Egypt and all across the region. Remember, it was here in this city, that another American stood before you. He told you that radical Islamist terrorism does not stem from an ideology. He told you that 9/11 led my country to abandon its ideals, particularly in the Middle East. He told you that the United States and the Muslim world needed, quote, a new beginning, end of quote. The results of these misjudgments, again talking about Obama, have been dire. I mean, there's a lot there to unpack. I would say all of it false, but nonetheless, let's pick it apart a little bit. Go ahead, Mohammed.
Well, I'll focus on just one element, and that is the notion that Obama said that the U.S. government abandoned its ideals after 9/11. 9/11 was a result of U.S. policy. 9/11 was a result of the United States supporting extremists, and this was not just in Afghanistan. We saw the same thing in Latin America. So this notion of American ideals and American exceptionalism and America being a force of good, the government at least, it's not reflective of the American people, obviously, is a myth. But on the other hand, Pompeo is being disingenuous, because Obama actually, when the so-called Arab Spring or the Awakening began, until almost the last moment, they supported the Mubarak regime against the people until the regime was about to be overthrown. And then the Muslim Brotherhood, when they came to power, regardless of how flawed the government was and how poorly managed the government in Egypt was, and the fact that the Muslim Brotherhood in different countries have different ideals, but the United States supported the coup. Again, this was an elected president in Egypt, whether you like him or not, and the United States, under Obama, allowed the coup in Egypt to take place. So Pompeo is being dishonest about Obama, but Obama, his representation of Obama is in no way accurate whatsoever. But what Pompeo is doing is that he is making this speech at the American University of Cairo in a country which is facing a horrible situation, a very awful government, very despotic, tens of thousands of people being held in prisons, many disappear, poverty on the rise, a very corrupt ruling class. And this is where the U.S. Secretary of State, who is supposedly a freedom-loving person, goes and makes a speech. And I think that says a lot about the American University of Cairo, by the way, as well.
Indeed, it does. We were speaking to Mohammed Marandi. Mohammed is an expert on American studies and post-colonial literature. He teaches at the University of Tehran. We're speaking to him from Beirut. Mohammed, we have about 40 seconds left. You know, I think I want to come back to the point that you made, that if it hadn't been for the U.S. supporting the so-called Mujahideen in Afghanistan back in 1978, 79, if it hadn't been for the invasion of Iraq by the United States in 2003, the destruction of the Gaddafi government in Libya in 2011, again led by a U.S.-led NATO military alliance bombing campaign, ISIS, the same extremist elements that Pompeo is talking about, they wouldn't be dominating in Libya or in Iraq or in Syria, not dominating, but even existing, at least certainly not in their current sort of strength. That's what you mean, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The United States, Brzezinski actually admitted that they helped these groups, these extremists, in order to encourage the Soviet Union to invade Afghanistan, to create a Vietnam for the Soviet regime. But the American government worked alongside Saudi Arabia to fund and help these extremists and to expand the ideology of Wahhabism for their own strategic purposes. And 9/11 was blowback. And the irony is that even after 9/11 and after the awakening or the Arab Spring, the Americans once again began to cooperate with these very same al-Qaeda groups, as we saw in Syria, where they're right now in Idlib, in northern Syria, in Libya, and in Yemen through Saudi Arabia.
We're going to leave it right there. We were joined from Beirut by Mohamed Marandi. Mohamed is an expert on American studies, post-colonial literature. He teaches at the University of Tehran. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Polish authorities arrested a Huawei sales executive, the second Huawei executive arrested in recent months. Huawei is a major, perhaps the largest Chinese technology company. Meanwhile, trade talks between the United States and China have continued all week, which is being interpreted as a positive sign by financial markets. Will there be a resolution of the recent U.S.-China trade war? We're joined from London by Jude Woodward. She is the author of the new book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. Jude Woodward, welcome back.
Hi there.
Hi. You know, I remember a story from a few weeks ago about a meeting that took place maybe 6 or 7 or 8 months ago between the intelligence chiefs of the so-called Five Eyes countries. That would be the United States, Canada, UK, New Zealand, and Australia, about Huawei. In other words, having a coordinated approach against Huawei. Now we had, on December 1st, the chief financial officer of Huawei arrested while she was changing planes in Vancouver, Canada. She's still in custody under house arrest in Canada. Now this latest action by the Polish government arresting a Huawei sales executive, it seems like internationally coordinated, U.S. coordinated effort against this Chinese technology company at the very moment that some hope was presented about the possibility that there could be a good outcome in this week's U.S.-China trade talks. What's your reaction?
Well, I would have said the same thing about the coordinated intervention. I don't think the two things are mutually exclusive. I think there can be some progress in the trade talks at the same time as a stepped-up campaign against Huawei. Clearly, what's happening with Huawei is that it started with the US. As you say, there was the Five Eyes meeting. Germany has now said that it's concerned about future contracts for 5G that involve Huawei. A number of other European countries, I can't remember which ones, obviously that includes Britain, have expressed similar concerns. This is all very recent. There's been absolutely no evidence for this whatsoever, that there's any risk, any more than there is a risk with American technology, which everybody knows is open to a backdoor to the American security services, that you have to pay for absolutely incredible, almost unavailable encryption to get systems that are not open to the US security services. I've no idea what, if anything, the Chinese have of this type, but you know, this is nothing, no evidence has been presented, and this is standard fare. But now there is a coordinated campaign against Huawei, and Huawei is shifting its attention to other markets because it's not assuming this is going to stop in the short term. But on the question of the trade talks, we'll see. That may have a slightly more positive outcome. We'll see.
I'm looking at the Wall Street Journal from today. Chinese Huawei executive is charged with espionage in Poland. Detention follows a U.S. push to dissuade allies around the world from using Huawei gear. And then the very first sentence, Polish authorities detained and charged a local sales director of Huawei Technologies Company, a Chinese national, with conducting high-level espionage on behalf of China amid widening global scrutiny by Washington and its allies of the technology giant. The arrest is another bombshell for Huawei following the earlier December detention of the company's chief financial officer in Canada at the U.S. request. Again, and not again, but in this case, on charges related to Iranian sanctions, U.S. sanctions against Iran. It must be a bombshell to China because for the longest time, at least since 1978, when the U.S. And China's relations changed when China began the opening up, allowing foreign direct investment by U.S. and Western firms into China. For these last, you know, years, decades now, since 1978, there was a presumption on the part of the Chinese that even if there was friction between the U.S. and China, even if there would be the inevitable friction between major powers, that they weren't hostile, you know, permanent hostile competitors locked into eventual conflict. But when you're arresting as part of a U.S. globally coordinated plan, the senior executives or regional executives of a major Chinese technology company and charging them with things like espionage, which could put them into prison for long periods of time, it makes it very hard for the same company to send its representatives abroad. It's got to feel like a bombshell to China.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think whatever else you may believe about Donald Trump, he has completely changed the relations of the West with China. When I wrote my book, which came out about a year ago, I was flagging up that this had been being prepared since the Obama presidency. But under Obama, the approach was much more carrot and stick. And Trump has totally shifted the pace, the level of aggression, and changed the whole international agenda. And there is going to be no short-term rolling back from this. We may get some rolling back from the trade war, which, because that has a rebound effect on the US economy and on the world economy, which may be unpalatable. But the overall approach, which is to drive back against China, to create problems for China, political problems for China, saber rattling towards China, trade threats towards China, this security scare that's been blown up. This is going to be part of a feature of the situation going well into the future.
Jude Woodward is our guest. Jude is the author of the new book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. And Jude, as you mentioned, I'm not saying it with the same inflection as your title would suggest, because your book, written a year ago, as you said, or published a year ago, ends with a question mark, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War, question mark. But I guess under the current circumstances, you could remove the question mark.
Well, exactly. I mean, at the time that we were discussing the title of the book, the publisher and I felt we should put the question mark, but because the public, the general public, the thinking public, did not really believe quite that this was going to happen, that there was going to be this total conflict between the US and China. I believe there was going to be, and that's what my book argues, that this was unavoidable. But indeed, yes, I think it's now clear and the question mark is unnecessary.
I'm looking at Global Times newspaper closely. It's not a party publication. It's not a publication of the Communist Party of China. But it is usually understood to reflect China's views or the views of the leadership. Poland bound to be a loser if it follows the U.S. in taking on Huawei. That's an important story on the front page of Global Times. What will China do towards Poland? And bigger picture, what will China do in order to perhaps be less vulnerable to in its foreign exposure?
Well, the first thing is that this is quite shocking for China, I think, because Poland and the Eastern European countries of the European Union have, on the whole, been rather friendlier towards China than the rest of Europe. They've been involved in this, I think it's called the 16 Plus Initiative, which is China plus a number of Eastern European countries, partly looking at things like the Belt and Road trade, but also more specific trade deals, aid and investments. And that's been a very important thing for Poland. And so Poland will now undoubtedly lose out on contracts it would otherwise have got. Whether China will do anything more up front, I think, depends on what is the actual situation and what happens next. But Poland will definitely suffer. It will no longer get the favorable treatment that it was getting before. Huawei is already looking to make its the focus much more in Africa, South America, Southeast Asia, East Asia, and looking at Russia and looking away from and the Chinese market itself, which of course is growing very fast, and where Apple's products, obviously they're not quite the same issue because Huawei does produce mobile phones, but it also produces telecom systems. But it's looking to diversify its markets away from those more directly influenced by the U.S. and the West.
That's the voice of Jude Woodward. Jude is the author of the new book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. We're talking to her about the new arrest of a Huawei executive, this time in Poland. Huawei is the major Chinese technology company. Yes, you're talking about Poland won't get contracts that would otherwise have come its way because the Chinese will do something. The Chinese obviously have to balance now between retaliation and trying to not have things blow up. I would guess if the Chinese government feels that there are different sectors or factions within the West and within the United States over U.S.-China relations, and one sector wants to blow things up by staging provocations like arresting Chinese executives, if China arrests American executives, for instance, it will be used pretextually to blow things up. They've arrested a couple Canadian executives. Anyway, we have about 20 seconds left. China has been prudent so far. Will that continue to be the path?
I think China's always extremely prudent, extremely careful, extremely coordinated and very thoughtful. Everything that's even said in the Western media about its trade negotiators, for example, is that they're very, very clever customers. And I think that's the way the Chinese will play it.
That was Jude Woodward. We talked to Jude from London. She's the author of the new book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Again, this week, we look at the worst, the most misleading, the funniest, and the just plain wrong headlines of the past week. Joining us from San Francisco, from the San Francisco Bay Area, is Steve Pat. Steve is an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News. That's L-E-F-T-I, the letter I, L-E-F-T-I, blogspot.com. Steve tweets at Left Eye Blog, and we're joined in studio by Nicole Russell. She's a Sputnik news analyst and one of the producers of this show. Steve Pat, Nicole, welcome back.
Thanks so much.
All right.
Hey, Steve Pat, guess what? A lot of bad, misleading, dumb, and some funny headlines. Where do we want to start?
For sure. Well, last week I started with rare praise for the Washington Post for actually calling out Trump as a liar in one of its headlines. And I'm afraid I have to take that all back because this week they're back to their old ways. So here's a headline from the Washington Post. No different, quote, no different from my original statements, quote, Trump denies changes to Syria exit plan. So this was Trump saying, you know, he never said that Trump troops were coming out immediately, which, of course, is a complete lie. We have video, we have audio, we have transcripts. But it took the Post until the fifth paragraph before they finally got around to saying both his comments and Trump's comments conflict with officials' initial statements following the president's unexpected December 19th announcement that the troops would come home in short order. I mean, it's just we all know he said they were coming home immediately. They even had a timeline, 30 days. The fact that he's now saying it's no different is an outrageous lie, and that they put that in the headline is just outrageous as well.
But the other thing that's, I would say, outrageous is the Washington Post doesn't want the troops to come out.
That too, yes.
I mean, you know, it's kind of this weird sort of coverage. They're really pillorying Trump for having said the troops were going to come out. And then as the media, like the Washington Post, beat up on Trump, and of course, some of his advisors beat up on the president, and some of the generals, certainly in the Pentagon and the military industrial complex establishment, beat up on Trump for daring to say the U.S. should end its illegal occupation of Syria, Trump is backpedaling. I mean, that really is the story. He's backpedaling about the timeline on the deadline. He doesn't want to look like he's changed his story. But the fact of the matter is, organizations like the Washington Post, based on pressure, have compelled Trump to do something he doesn't want to do, which is to slow the thing down. Anyway, we're not fans of Trump, but I think that's right. Don't you, Steve?
For sure.
Okay, let's go on to the next story.
Which is also from the Washington Post and definitely qualifies as by far the worst story and the worst headline of the week. It's something you discussed yesterday in your criminal injustice segment, but there's a couple more things to say about it. The headline reads as follows, quote, "I've been eaten like a boss," quote, "federal prisoners serve steak by unpaid guards during shutdown."
Yeah, that is disgusting. He's right. It's the worst one.
And the whole idea that prisoners are eating high off the hog it would be a joke if it wasn't sick. But the worst thing about this story, which you didn't mention yesterday, is that for the first 12 hours online before a flood of criticism forced them to take it down, this article was accompanied by a picture of a high-end steak like you'd find in the finest New York restaurant served on fine china. I mean, they didn't want the readers to have to imagine what the steak would look like in this prison. They gave them this fantasy. I mean, it's just unbelievable. And they finally were forced to replace this picture with a picture. And they couldn't eat, rather than replace it with a picture of a typical prison meal, which might have, you know, grossed out their readers, they replaced it just with a picture of a prisoner behind bars, which actually had, you know, nothing to do with the story per se. As offensive as the headline was, the picture was even more offensive.
You know, newspaper articles actually describing and actually with, you know, images of what really shows up on people's plates in prisons do gross people out pretty regularly, because when those actually so rarely are truly covered, what's really on prisoners' plates, it's, you know, frozen meat rock, so to speak, which is just a who knows blend of some sorts of meats. I've heard from prisoners that is a common occurrence, but also, you know, just frozen, terrible carbs that are just piled onto a plate, and the only vegetable you might get is you know, like a canned.
John Kiriakou talked about this. Federal prisoners, and he was a federal prisoner, they get steak once a year, so-called steak. Not high-end, not served on china.
No, I mean, it's served on a cafeteria tray, like always, right? Or, like, if you're in solitary, it's whatever you get is slid into your cell. That is a very, very, very different image than what actually, you know, or that was shown.
A disgusting story. Let's go on to the next one.
Well, one more thing that's really worth noting about this story, I think. The quote in the headline comes from an email, which was allegedly, we don't know if it's really true, was sent by an inmate and was read by prison guards who forwarded it to the union president, who then made it public by revealing it to a reporter, which is a grotesque violation of the prisoner's privacy. I mean, yes, their emails and their letters, the prison does have a right to read them, but they do not have a right to release them to the public.
Yeah. And the Washington Post doesn't have the right, nor does it complain about the lack of a right to actually interview the prisoners. It's about the prisoners, but it's not from the prisoners in any way. Anyway, let's keep going.
Okay, we're turning now to Russiagate. And this is also a story that Manafort gave the polling data to Kalimnik story that you've talked about before. But I want to focus on some headlines. Here's a series of headlines. This one's from the Washington Post, which is reasonable. Paul Manafort shared 2016 polling data with Russian associate, which would be Kalimnik, according to court filing. Then we go to the Huffington Post. Mueller thinks Paul Manafort shared Trump polling data with Russian operative. Now he's a Russian operative. But then the worst headline, which was repeated elsewhere, from the New York Magazine, by Jonathan Chait, who's one of the notorious Russiagaters in the media. Trump's campaign manager gave polling data to Russian agent. And the first sentence of the article says that Manafort shared polling data with Konstantin Kalimnik, a Russian intelligence agent. Now, Kalimnik may be a Russian intelligence agent. I don't know. I don't have a list of Russian intelligence agents. But what we know publicly is that he was a translator for the Soviet Army, not the Russian Army, but the Soviet Army more than 30 years ago. That is literally the only thing that is publicly known about this man as far as intelligence and connections with the Russian government. And yet here he's being smeared as an out-and-out Russian intelligence agent. And I heard this exactly the same thing, by the way. I was listening to Fox News yesterday, and Judge Napolitano, who's one of their legal commentators, again, just out-and-out stated that Kalimnik is a Russian intelligence agent. Not that he's claimed to be or thought to be, but he is. So that's the line that's going through the media, and it's outrageous because there's no public evidence of that.
Yeah. And I mean, this Jonathan Shea was rightfully torn down for this on Twitter yesterday. I mean, this is outrageous. And the way that we title these sorts of things is incredibly important. But, you know, the title, the headline was directly pulled from Jonathan Chait. So it's not really even the headline's fault. It's Jonathan Chait for sure.
And we've talked about also this point that while that headline, the one that you thought wasn't as bad, but the story is bad because it shows, it intends to show that Manafort gave polling data to Kilimnik, who is a former Manafort business associate, so that he could give it to Oleg Deripaska, the Russian oligarch billionaire with who has ties to the Kremlin or is Vladimir Putin's friend. The next day, the New York Times took it back, and we talked about this. The headline was big. The story got picked up everywhere. The headline, though, is the next day. It's called Corrections, January 10th, 2019. You wouldn't even know it's about the story. And then it's two sentences, an article on Wednesday about a court filing indicating that Paul Manafort shared polling data with a contact of Russian intelligence, misidentified the people to whom Mr. Manafort wanted the contact to send the data. They weren't Russians. They were Ukrainians. And of course, maybe because they're Slavs or because Ukraine used to be part of the Soviet Union, none of it matters. But again, the headline dominated the news. The corrections missed it. Matter of fact, we were talking earlier, Steve, last night on the National Network News and on NPR, they repeated the story at least 12 hours after the New York Times retracted it in major broadcast news as if it's still true.
On my Facebook feed, I saw a post by Robert Reich shared by one of my friends all about sharing the data with Deripaska. And I checked Robert Reich's Facebook feed and his articles and so on. He hasn't retracted it yet. So as little as the correction in the New York Times was seen by anyone, the correction to the secondary stories, the stories that picked it up from the New York Times, is even fewer or non-existent. So the story continues to propagate.
Unfortunately, Steve, we are getting close to being out of time. 1 minute left. What's your next headline?
Well, we got to talk about this story, which is from the Washington Post. And this is the headline you didn't expect to see. That sophisticated, specific Russian 2016 voter targeting effort doesn't seem to exist. And this is finally an article, which is the flip side of this whole, you know, Kilimnik, Manafort, Deripaska, et cetera, story, which is that if they were really sharing polling data with anyone in the Kremlin or the IRA or anything, you'd think they might have put that data to use. But they didn't, because the states where the most ads were run were Texas and New York, neither one of which was in close at all in the campaign. And the states which were run narrowly, like Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, had very few campaigns and ads. And this was an article in the Washington Post finally reveals this, although this same information came out in a November 2017 hearing in the Senate. And there's a report from Richard Burr, the chairman of that committee, which details all of exactly the same information.
And this Washington Post report actually includes the fact that we talk about all the time. Most of these ads were seen after the election. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have.
We were joined from San Francisco, from the San Francisco area, by Steve Pat. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been the feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News. That's L-E-F-T, the letter I on the news. Or go to lefteye.blogspot.com. Steve tweets at Left Eye Blog. We were also joined in studio by Nicole Roussel. She is a Sputnik News analyst and a producer of this show. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back on Monday. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear, with Brian Becker for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and clear. Oh,